FM.
Stay relevant and up to date. Keep informed. This is 101.9 High FM.
You're listening to 101.9 High FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review, your favorite Jewish current affairs and culture show. Welcome to the program. Nice to be with you once again. And in the show today, we are starting off the first of what I hope will be a number of shows dedicated to the founding of the State of Israel and talking about how it was created, this being the 70th year of Israel. So we're very excited to be doing this on the show in terms of getting the history, really, of Israel across to people who may not have been around. And what better way to start off a series such as this than with none other than Smokey, or Harold Smokey Simon. He was a fighter pilot in the early years of the start of the state, and really at the beginning of the IAF, and a Machal volunteer amongst the 800 South Africans that fought for the creation of Israel. And I'm really, really pleased and honored that he is spending some time with us today to talk about his experiences. Smokey, thank you so much for being with us on 101.9 High FM.
It's my pleasure, Benji.
So, for a start, you were a fighter bomber pilot. Excuse me. You were very involved in both World War II and the Independence War. But before we get into that, what got you into flying in the first place?
Firstly, I'd like to make a correction.
Yes,
I wasn't a fighter pilot. I was a navigator bombardier. That was my profession, as it were. In the South African Air Force.
Okay, correct.
Well, you will recall that World War II started in September 1939, and I was at university at Wits at that time, and interestingly, the government of South Africa took a decision that no student in his final year would be allowed to enlist. He had to complete his finals, which turned out to be an absolute blessing. So I finished my finals. I had 2 degrees, a BCom and a Chartered Accountant, South Africa. And the moment I finished my last examination and put my pen down, I signed up with the South African Air Force. And I was trained as a navigator bombardier. And as you will remember, World War II came to an end in 1945 when Germany surrendered in May. And Japan surrendered in August.
So, Smokey, can you tell me what is it? What was your role on the plane? What is it that you did in terms of your function?
Well, I was in bomber command. You know, there's fighter command and bomber command and coastal command and so forth. So my first tour of operations was with bomber command, and there capacity of a navigator bombardier, we were really responsible on a bomber aircraft for the navigation and then really for attacking the target. We were the guys who really dropped the bombs. So that was my function in the South African Air Force, and I was discharged at the end in November 1945 after 5 years of service. After I had completed my first what we call tour of operations in Bomber Command, I was then transferred to Coastal Command, and that involved submarine hunting and ship escorts and naval reconnaissance, etc.
So what were your theatres of operation? Where did you fly during World War II?
Well, in Bomber Command, I was mainly in North Africa, where a lot of South Africans were engaged, both in the ground forces and in the air force. We were really part of what was called the Desert Air Force. The air officer commanding was British, and there were a number of Dominion air crews. When I say Dominion, that was South Africa, Canada, Australia, and Britain. And that was the main, I should say, engagement, where I was concerned, was really as part of the Desert Air Force. You will remember that the German commander was an amazingly effective guy. He was Rommel, and the German objective was really to get to the oil fields in the Middle East. And that's why the war in North Africa was of critical importance.
And you were actually involved with the Battle of El Alamein, is that correct?
Exactly. I was just about to refer to that, that the Battle of El Alamein was really the first serious Allied victory in World War II. You know, the war started in September 39, and El Alamein took place in October 1942, 3 years later, and that was really the first serious Allied victory in World War II. And it was really a question of driving the German army out of North Africa. And so we moved from Egypt and then into Libya and then into Tunisia and then into Malta and then into Sicily and then into Italy. And at that stage, I completed my first tour of operations. And happily, I came out unharmed, and after a month's leave, I did a training course in Coastal Command in Britain, England and Scotland at the time, and I did my second tour of operations, as I said, in Coastal Command, and again, I would remind you that the war actually was completed, or rather against Germany, in May 1945. Our squadron was then gearing up to go to the Far East in the war against Japan. And then the Americans really were responsible for the concluding drama of dropping the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
That was the end of the
war against Japan, and I was discharged from the Air Force in November 1945.
Smokey,
I had served for 5 years.
I wanted to ask you just on the Japan issue. You know, a lot of what I think people know about bombing aircraft comes from movies like Pearl Harbor that, you know, was related to the war in Japan. But can you give us a sense about what is it like to be inside a bombing airplane if you are, you know, bombing a target in a desert or hunting a submarine? Is it nerve-wracking? Is it dangerous? What is it like to actually be inside one of these machines when you're on a mission such as this?
Benji, I would say that there was always a feeling of tension. You know, here I would introduce the fact that you know, in South Africa, we had a number of German refugees who had come out to South Africa. And when I heard their stories of, and this is before we knew anything about the Holocaust, but when I heard the stories of the anti-Semitism in Germany and the oppression of the Jews, I developed a deep hostility towards the Germans. I felt that whatever I could do to damage, in fact, to kill the Germans, was really a responsibility on my part to, in a small way, to make up for what they had done to the Jewish people. So, you know, my feelings were probably different, were surely different to the feelings of a non-Jew who was involved in the fighting. When we come on to the story of Israel, it was really an extension of that, you might call it emotional motivation that I had in inflicting as much damage as, in my small way, I could really do to the Germans.
So actually, let's come on to that, Smokey, and talk about what happened with Israel. You finished your tour of duty doing World War II, working in the both the desert and the water, the aqua divisions, and then you came back to South Africa. So what made you realize that there was going to be a conflagration in the Middle East that you had to get involved in? And please tell us a story also about how you schlepped along your fiancé at the time as well.
You know, after the war, like all other ex-servicemen, I was rehabilitating myself. I opened a small office in Joburg. And then we saw the war clouds gathering over Palestine. The United Nations decision on the issue of partition was in November 1947. And it was really became clear that there was going to be a war in Palestine. The South African Zionist Federation, they were absolutely fantastic. They started recruiting veterans from World War II to go to Israel to fight against the Arabs. And then there was the Jewish Ex-Servicemen's League, or the guys who had fought in World War II. And, you know, we were a small community in South Africa, really, when you think 120,000 souls. And so there was close contact between the guys who had served and who were rehabilitating themselves. And when the United Nations resolution was taken in November 1947, the war clouds were gathering. There was no doubt that there was going to be the conflict in the Middle East. So I was engaged at the time to my wife, Myra. She had served in the South African Air Force. She had been trained as a meteorologist. And we discussed the matter. And I said, you know, we'll have to postpone our wedding because I'm going to Palestine. And she said, well, I'm also going to Palestine. So we got married, and we were really in the first group of South Africans under the auspices of the Zionist Fed. You may recall the name of Simi Weinstein, who was really a key player in recruiting guys. He was a wonderful fellow. And as I said, Myra and I were in the first group of South Africans. We arrived in Palestine on the 9th of May, 48. It was quite an interesting. The flight took us 6 days because we were held up in Cyprus. The captain on the aircraft said, "Look, they're fighting at Lida Airport, and I can't fly there as had been arranged because I can't endanger my passengers and the aircraft. And you've got to find some other means of getting to Palestine." So we negotiated with an aviation company in Cyprus, and they agreed to fly us to Haifa. We said, that's fine. And when we arrived in Haifa, there was tremendous activity because the British Army was evacuating at that time. And you probably remember there were 80,000 British troops in Palestine. And we were a little bit concerned that if they arrested us or prevented us as from coming to Palestine, because Myra, my wife, had some important documents which she had hidden in her girdle for Ben Gurion. And we thought that if we're going to be searched, there could be trouble. But the British were preoccupied with their evacuation, so that passed off very peacefully.
Sorry, I apologize to interrupt the great discussion. We've got to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to hear more about your story. We're talking to Harold Smoky Simon today about the creation of the Israel Air Force, amongst others.
Stay relevant and up to date. Keep informed. This is 101.9 High FM.
You arrived in Israel with your wife, and you had a special delivery for Ben Gurion. What was your next move?
We arrived on the 9th, and we signed on for service in the Air Force on the 10th of May. And if one looks at the historical perspective at the time, the decade of the 1940s was just a tremendous confluence of momentous events. There was the Holocaust, which we became aware of, and then there was the termination of the British mandate over Palestine, which was due to terminate on the night of the 14th, 15th May. Then there was a declaration of the State of Israel, and then on the 14th of May, and on that same day, the first Arab country army to attack Israel was the Jordanian army, also known as the Arab Legion, which had been trained by the British and supplied by the British with armament and led by the British. That was the first Arab army to attack Israel, and so the War of Israel, the War of Independence, really started.
Now, but as part of that, you were actually involved with a range of different missions, in terms of the Israeli Air Force, including bombing both Egypt and Syria. What was the idea behind that?
I'll really come to that in just a few minutes, if you don't mind, Benji, because sure. I was dealing with a historical perspective, and as I said, the war started on the 14th of May. With the attack by the Jordanian army. And on the 15th, on Saturday, the 15th of May, five other armies attacked Israel. There was Egypt and Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Kauchi. And the War of Independence, and I'd just like to make a few interesting and important points there. The War of Independence was Israel's longest war. It lasted from the 14th of May 48 to the 7th of January 49, 8 months. It was Israel's costliest war. We lost 6,300 military and civilians, apart from thousands who were disabled and injured. And it was Israel's most fateful war. If we had lost that war, we wouldn't be having our interview today.
Yeah, absolutely.
So these are the points that I'd really like to stress from the historical and the Jewish point of view. So if I can continue along that line, there was an enormous military imbalance in favor of the Arabs. Egypt, for example, had 62 Spitfire aircraft, which was, as you may know, one of the iconic combat planes in World War II. The Jordanian army had been supplied by the British, the Syrians and the Libyans, and the Lebanese had been supplied by the French. Israel did not have a single combat aircraft at the time, and not a single anti-aircraft gun. Now, and then to add to the problem, the United Nations imposed an arms embargo on the Middle East, which really mainly affected Israel. And in addition to that, the American government passed the Neutrality Act, which made it a serious offense to export military equipment without official permits. So Israel had a range of institutions against us: the United Nations observers, the FBI, the CIA, MI6, Scotland Yard. You see, these are all, I think, tremendously important factors in when we really try to analyze what happened in 1948. I think you may agree with me, Benji.
Absolutely, Smokey. I mean, I think if you look at the historical context of the kind of stuff that you're involved in, it's almost miraculous in some ways that that Israel survived at all, and quite incredible. And what I'd really love to hear from you, you know, I think that for a lot of people, this sort of stuff is sometimes dry and in the history books, and to have the opportunity to speak to someone who actually lived it, I think is a real sort of honor and opportunity for us here in Johannesburg. So what I'd love to hear from you is, like, you know, what was it like? What kind of things did you have to get involved in against all of these odds?
Well, you see, I should just mention that there were predictions of doom. The American Secretary of State, George Marshall, he said that it was a grave mistake and irresponsible for Israel to declare its independence. This war is going to be over in 2 weeks' time. Ernest Bevin, who was a rabid anti-Semite, who was a foreign minister in Britain at the time, his prediction was also 2 weeks. And Montgomery, the who was then a field marshal, he said that when the British flag is lowered over Palestine, the Jews are going to be wiped out. And Abdul Azam Pasha, the Secretary General of the Arab League, said, if the Zionists dare declare a state, the massacre that would be unleashed against them would dwarf what Hitler had done to the Jewish people, and that this was going to be a war of extinction. So all those predictions of doom, you know, as far as the top echelon in Israel was concerned, was certainly very, very disconcerting. And then the war started badly. By the way, on Friday the 14th of May, at the very time that Ben-Gurion was declaring the state, I had the privilege of flying on the very first mission of the Israel Air Force. Boris Senior, also an ex-South African, Machnik, was the pilot, and I was the navigator, and we had an Israeli aerial photographer. And we had to, our mission was to do a reconnaissance over Jordan and to report to the staff of the Israel army as to the of the Jordanians. And they were equipped with tanks and armored cars and artillery and troops and trucks. And in fact, they had already overrun the Etzion block, which they burnt down to the ground. And we became aware subsequently that 240 military and civilians were killed and 420 taken prisoners of war. So that was the situation that we saw on the 14th of May. And Jerusalem was under siege. The Jordanians had cut off the road between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. There was a shortage of water and food and armaments. And then the Israel army made a number of attacks on the fortress at Latrun, which had been handed over by the British to the Jordanian army, very strategically situated. And then there was the Egyptian Air Force, which was bombing Tel Aviv day after day and strategic targets in Israel, and we had nothing to stop it. And the Egyptian army had overrun the kibbutzim in the south, and they had advanced up to Ashdod, which is 30 kilometers from Tel Aviv. The situation was desperately serious. Shimon Avidan, who was the commander of the Israeli forces on that front, he was in a desperately difficult situation. He said that unless there was an air attack to stop the Egyptians, they would be in Tel Aviv on the next day, 30th of May, where the provisional government was seated, and the war would be over. And all those dire predictions really looked as though they were going to come to pass. And on that date, there was an absolute miracle. Believe me, Benji, the Almighty intervened on Israel's part. what had happened was that the first four aircraft were assembled in Israel. And how did we get those aircraft? Now, this is something which is terribly important. The one and only country that came to Israel's aid was Czechoslovakia. We owe Czechoslovakia a deep and unforgettable debt because they saved the state of Israel. Nothing less than that. They saved the state of Israel. We had bought 25 Avia 199 aircraft, which was popularly referred to as the Czechoslovakian Messerschmitt. It was far inferior to the German model, but in any event, you will ask, how did we get these four aircraft? Well, that's a fantastic story. So, Benji, you know, I'm just leading you into the momentum of events to try and illustrate the situation at the time and how it developed. Is that okay with you, Benji?
Absolutely, Smokey. It's you know, fascinating to hear the history. We're actually just going to take another short break, and when we come back, I want to hear that. I want to hear that story. I want to hear about. I want to hear about some of the other missions as well as some of the other personalities. We're talking to Smokey Simon today. He flew one of the first missions of the Israeli Air Force back in 1948. How crazy is that? We'll be back just after this.
Stay relevant and up to date. Keep you informed. This is 101.9 High FM.
You're back with 101.9 High FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review, and we're talking to Smokey Simon. He was one of the original pilots, in the Israel Air Force, and a South African. And we're talking to him because this year is the 70th anniversary of Israel. Now Smokey, you were saying just before the break about these planes. Can you tell us a story of how you got them into Israel?
Let me introduce the subject of Mahal. I told you how the very serious situation which was prevailing at the time, and we came to the 29th of May, when the Egyptian army had advanced. They had overrun the kibbutzim in the south, and they had reached Ashdod, 30 kilometers from Tel Aviv. And the deep concern of the commander of the Israel forces on that front. So we really now come to the Mahal story. Now, as you know, Mahal is really an acronym for Mitnadrei Chutz La'aretz, volunteers from abroad. There were 4,800 Mahalniks who came to help Israel over the period of the war. They weren't 4,800 at any one moment, but they came in different stages across the war. They came from 59 countries, and they included 168 non-Jews. Now, the importance of Mahal cannot be overstated. These guys had the experience that they had acquired in World War II. Israel had the Haganah, which was a very well trained military force under the limited circumstances at the time. But here you had thousands of volunteers who came with the knowledge and the experience of World War II. The Air Force was mainly from the United States and South Africa and Britain and Canada. Now, there were some very outstanding personalities. Mickey Marcus, who had been a colonel in the American Army, was put in charge of the Jerusalem Front, and he was responsible for building the Burma Road, which was a second road between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, because the main road had, as I said, been cut off by the Jordanians. Unfortunately, he was tragically killed, and posthumously, he was awarded the rank of Aluf, which was the highest rank in the Israel Army, which Aluf is the equivalent of what we call a full general in our terms.
And in fact, there was South Africans as well. Cecil Margo, for example, was very involved with the Air Force.
Yeah. Well, let me say this, that Cecil was a very experienced guy. To this day, I regret that he turned down Ben-Gurion's offer of commanding the Air Force. You know, he gave advice. It's all very well giving advice of what the Air Force structure should be. The bomber division and the fighter division and the transport division and the reconnaissance division and so forth. But what do you do when you don't have those aircraft? Mm-hmm. Theoretically, that's a great setup. But from a practical point of view, those were the problems. The Air Force had two formidable problems. The Air Force, how do you acquire aircraft? And when you do acquire them, how do you get them to Israel? Those were the main problems. Cecil, no man under the sun could have said, this is the solution to it. Now, as I said, Czechoslovakia played such an important role. So, to get back to the Machelniks, Al Schwimmer was a flight engineer in the American Air Force in World War II. He was a man of tremendous vision and courage. This guy smuggled 11 C-46 huge transport aircraft, two Skymasters, three Constellations, and four B-17 heavy bombers out of the United States of America.
It's amazing. It's quite incredible.
Yeah. And where did they take these aircraft? Oh, they were smuggled out to Czechoslovakia, the only base in the world that they could take these aircraft to. And then they flew on the most circuitous routes in order to shake off the FBI and the CIA. In fact, one of the bombers was arrested and impounded by the FBI, and out of the four huge B-17 bombers, we lost 25% of the bomber force.
Wow, it's quite incredible, Smokey, to think about what lengths people had to go to get the weapons needed to defend the state. Smuggling whole planes, is quite remarkable. We're talking to Smokey Simon today on 101.9 Chai FM. He's talking to us about the creation of the Israel Air Force, which he was very much a part. Smokey, just in the interest of time, because we are coming towards the end of the show, I do want to get the stories from you about how you bombed Damascus and Egypt, including not even using real bombs, using bottles and all this sort of thing. Why would you do something like that?
I was talking about Al Schwimmer.
Yes.
We set up this air bridge, we called that organization Air Transport Command, which was parallel to the Israel Air Force. So you had the Air Force, mm-hmm. and you had Air Transport Command.
So these
aircraft were the components of the Alveas were flown to Israel. And the first four aircraft were the reassembly was completed on the 29th of May. So, Benji, I want to remind you, the Egyptian army was 30 kilometers from Tel Aviv on the 29th of May. By the 29th of May, four aircraft had been reassembled in the utmost secrecy because we wanted to conceal the fact from the Egyptians that Israel had acquired these aircraft.
Were you working with Al to actually get these things into the country?
Yes.
And that's why you were creating this parallel structure to the Air Force as a way of smuggling
correct.
The planes.
That's correct. And as I said, because of those aircraft, we were able to establish an air bridge between Czechoslovakia and Tel Nof Air Base in Israel. So they were the aircraft were disassembled in Czechoslovakia, packed into the C-46s and Skymasters, and flown over to Israel, and then reassembled in Israel. We had some Czech mechanics and South Africans and Machol and Israelis, and these aircraft were assembled. And because of the utmost secrecy in concealing this from the Egyptians, these aircraft were not even test flown, and their armaments weren't checked because of secrecy. And these four aircraft went into action on the 29th of May in an air strike against the Egyptian army. Now, they were led, the formation of four aircraft was led by Lou Lennart, who had been a fighter pilot in the Marine Air Force of the United States during World War II. And then there was a South African by the name of Eddie Cohen, who unfortunately was killed in this attack. And two Israelis, two very well-known Israelis, Asa Weitzman and Modi Alon. And they, Lou Lennart, in his first attack, he spotted a petrol bowser, and he bombed it. And this thing had made a tremendous explosion and started widespread fires. And the four aircraft did four runs over the target. Every bullet and cannon shell was fired on the Egyptians. The Egyptians were absolutely stunned. They were destabilized. They started dispersing, and they never advanced beyond Ashdod. And when you're next in Israel, and you travel south, out at the entrance to Ashdod, there's a large sign which says, Ad Halom, up to here. And that's where the Egyptian army was stopped. And Tel Aviv was saved, and the State of Israel was saved.
And did you ever fly? Were you involved with the actual flying of those missions, or were you just involved with getting all the planes?
No. Yeah, I'll tell you. I had actually in June of 1948, I was appointed Chief of Air Operations of the Air Force. Oh. So I wasn't involved in as a air crew at all, but of course I was involved in the general picture at the time.
Right.
And so that, I say, was an absolute miracle that on the 29th of May, Israel had leave four combat aircraft which had been completed, which had not been tested. The risk of flying these aircraft was enormous. It's unheard of that you don't test fly the aircraft and that you don't test the armament capabilities. But because of secrecy, it was decided this is a risk we're going to take. And the State of Israel and the War of Independence was saved on the 29th of May, 1948. This was one of the greatest moments in the history of the Israel Air Force for all time.
Smokey,
and you these facts really are, they're not known. They're not known by 0.0002% of the population. And so today I give lectures to units in the Army and to the Air Force. These guys are stunned when they really hear how we survived this war. It was an absolute miracle, like the biblical miracles, I'm telling you, Benji.
No, Smokey, it's absolutely amazing.
On that day, those four aircraft.
Smokey, we've actually just, it's incredible, I could speak to you all day, but we've actually come to the end of the show for today, so perhaps we'll have to do another episode with you where we can chat further about some of your other exploits. But thank you so much for coming on the show with us today and telling us some of these early stories about the War of Independence.
It's my pleasure, Benji. I'm happy to really narrate what happened to our little country. And when you think of it, 70 years ago, we were really on the cusp of one of the greatest disasters in Jewish history.
No, absolutely.
Because, you know, all those events that I told you about in the 1948 decade was a pinnacle of 2,000 years of Jewish history.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
The big question was, how was that pinnacle going to end? And thank God it ended in victory. It was unheard of, unparalleled victory in the War of Independence when you think how Israel started off. So that in brief is really the story up to that point.
And hopefully we're going to have Smokey on again at some point to continue the story. But if you want, you can go check out his page on Machal, where if you just Google Smokey Simon, and you can go read his page. Smokey, thank you once again for coming on 101.9 Chai FM and sharing your very important story.
Okay, it's my pleasure, and Chag Sameach, and I wish you well.
That brings us to the end of the show for today. Thank you so much for listening. And check out Smokey Simon's Machal page and you can get the full insight into what he's all about. But for now, that brings us to the end of the show and we'll chat to you next week.